This morning, I want to discuss a verse on impermanence and explore something about the nature of transmission and translation, how we encounter an old sutra or an old poem, in what form, and how do we bring it forward into our current life and understanding. The poem is an ode by Horace, who died in 8 BC. That means he lived at the time of the end of the Roman Republic, the assassination of Julius Caesar, through the civil war that followed, and into the establishment of a relatively stable and peaceful empire under Augustus. So he had seen a lot and lived through a lot. Now, although this poem is about 2,000 years old, we have a clear text of it. It was published in his lifetime, and the texts have come down to us pretty directly. We have a good biography of him. So that even though we're talking, you know, about 2,000 years, the text itself is relatively stable and reliable. This makes it different from what we encounter in either the case of Shakyamuni or Homer, both of whom give us texts that were transmitted orally but not written down for, until a long time after they died. And in the case of Shakyamuni, like the case of Jesus, his words were written down first in a language that he didn't speak. Sutras are in Pali, which was not Shakyamuni's language, and the Gospel is written down in Greek, which Jesus did not speak. So whenever we talk about the authenticity of a teaching or a text, we first of all have to look at what's the actual text that we're dealing with. Where did it come from? How are we receiving it? How many intermediate steps are there that are missing between us and the author? So Horace's ode from the second book of odes, this is number 14. They don't have titles, they're just numbered that way. This one begins, Ehu fugakes posthume posthume labuntorani nec pietas moram ruges et instantati senectae et ferat in dominaeque morti. Now, I don't know how many of you have studied Latin and can follow any of this. When I was in high school, I took 4 years of Latin, was able to take an advanced placement test, get some credit for Latin, of one semester in Latin, but when I got to college, I still had to take another semester of Latin for my language requirement. And I enrolled in a course at Horace. which was not something a freshman ought to have done. I should have taken an introductory Latin class, but I put myself in this more advanced class in Horace, and I don't think anybody else was in there who wasn't going to be a classicist, so making a major out of it. But somehow I managed to muddle through it, and I think I ended up with a B at least. But I say that because it's also important to think about how do we first encounter a text. See, I encountered this poem as a student in a foreign language, and I worked at it with a dictionary by my side. It's very different than encountering it as a child, as a story told to you by your parents, or something that you hear in your native language in church every week, right? How do these stories first come to us? As Western Buddhists, very few of us had any of these stories told to us as children or something that we came by when we were growing up. We're getting it all secondhand. We may or may not be looking at any of the texts in the original languages, but we're not growing up with it. If we look at the Latin here, the first word, ehu, is like a sigh or an exclamation. It's usually translated as alas. And so it sort of starts. And the F-U-G there, you'll hear the root of fugitive, right? So it's fleeting. Alas, fleeting, posthume. And for us, there's an echo of the word posthumous in that name, right? Posthume is he's just addressing his friend by name. But it has this connotation to us. And we're going to have to, as we go along, try to identify the tone of the poem. As I say, this is about impermanence. Fugaces ani, the fleeting years, right? And he's going to say that nothing you can do, none of your piety is going to hold back rugas, wrinkles, or indomitaque morti, indomitable death, right? But what is the tone of this? We need to think that as we hear the translation. Is this like Polonius talking, some platitudinous statement about the inevitability of death? Is it just talking about resignation? Is there an air of acceptance in it? What kind of perspective do we think we're going to get on death from this poem? Now, first I'm going to read what's basically a crib, a literal translation. And then I'm going to read two more relatively contemporary versions for comparison. So this is a literal translation. Alas, posthumous, the swift years slip away, nor does piety bring delay for wrinkles and looming old age and fierce death. Not even if, however many days go by, my friend, you may appease pitiless Pluto with 300 bulls at a time. He who restrains triply large Geryon and Titios with the gloomy water, which surely must be sailed by us all, whoever of us enjoys a gift of earth, whether we be kings or poor farmers. In vain, we will abstain from bloody Mars and the broken waves of the raucous Adriatic Sea. In vain, through autumn, we will fear the south wind, harmful to our bodies. The dark Cocytus River, wandering with a sluggish stream, must be visited, and the notorious family of Danaus and Sisyphus Eleodes condemned to a long labor. Your land and your home and your pleasing wife must be abandoned. Nor will any of these trees which you maintain follow you, a short-lived master, except the hated cypresses. Your more worthy heir will waste your Kaikubian wine, guarded by 100 keys, and he will stain the pavement with arrogant wine, better than the dinner of the high priests. Now, I think most of us would find the diction of that poem pretty clotted. Doesn't easily roll off the tongue in English the way it might in Latin. And there are many references in there that most of us won't immediately recognize. Do we know who Geryon and Tityos were? Horace presumes that his readers know these were monsters in the old Greek mythology who were condemned to hell. Geryon was a triply large Geryon. He was a three-headed or three-faced monster killed by Hercules. Tityos was a giant punished for attempted rape by being chained to a rock and have his liver eaten, like we hear from Prometheus. The Cocytus River was one of the rivers of Hades, like the Styx is the more familiar name of it. The notorious family of Danaus. These were 50 daughters of a Greek king who were forcibly betrothed to the sons of an Egyptian king, I believe. And on their wedding night, all of them murdered their husbands. They're paired with Sisyphus because they too were given a task in Hades of trying to wash off their sins by filling up a bathtub that endlessly leaked, so they've never had enough water to wash off their sins. Right? So these are all sort of the background references of the poem that is going to be, we're going to have to look up, but Horace presumes that his readers will know. So the first task of a translator is to, how much of that backstory do you fill in, or how much do you try to find a modern equivalents to convey the same sense without keeping to the literal stories? The tone of this, in sort of the literal way, seems fairly resigned to me. Mostly it's saying, you can't hold on, you can't hold on. Everything is going to pass away and you have to go to Hades along with all these people you hear about in mythology. And I think for us, one of the things that we have to note is that the Greeks and Romans, when they thought about the afterlife, had a hell, but they didn't have a heaven, right? There's no sense of the afterlife being a place of your just reward or any bliss in being united with God. At best, you were a wandering shadow. At worst, you were tortured for your sins. Yeah. So I think that my own sense of Horace is that he's, in a certain way, teasing a rich friend who is very proud of his estate with its beautiful trees and its great wine cellar and his lovely wife. And he's teasing them that all that's going to go, you know, you better don't act too proud. But the tone literally is one of that's sort of very grim and resigned and talks about all this mythological stuff. But I think there's a irony in there that a literal translation can miss. So we're going to next read a translation by Basil Bunting that's done this is from 1971. And it's keeps some of the same points, but is trimmed down and has a different diction. Let's see how this sounds to you. You can't grip years, Posthume, that ripple away, nor hold back wrinkles and soon now age, nor can you tame death, not if you paid 300 bulls every day that goes by to Pluto, who has no tears, who has diked up giants where we'll go aboard, we who feed on the soil to cross kings some penniless plowmen. For nothing we keep out of war or from screaming spindrift or wrap ourselves against autumn for nothing, seeing we must stare at that dark, slow drift and watch the damned toil while all they build tumbles back on them. We must let earth go and home, wives too, and your trim trees, yours for a moment, save one sprig of black cypress. Better men will empty bottles we locked away, wine puddle our table, fit wine for a pope. Now, I think the flow of this as a poem works obviously much better for our modern ears. He was an Englishman from the Northumberland that has a sort of particular accent and very Anglo-Saxon vocabulary and diction that he tries to play with here. But he keeps sort of the reference to piety as sacrificing 300 bulls to Pluto, the god of the underworld. But otherwise he's eliminated all the classical references, though in the background you have this sense of we still have to cross that river of Hades, whether you're a king or a plowman, right? He ends with a line about fit wine for a pope. And you might think that pope is an anachronism. But if you look at the Latin, you see it's actually a bit of a pun, because where in the literal translation he says, better than the dinner of the high priests, the Latin for high priest is pontificum. So you have the word pontiff as a Latin high priest, and Bunting takes pontiff and pun basically makes a pun and makes it fit for a pope. So giving you the image like of of the Medicis, a medieval pope who lives in splendor. Right? Let me missing a page here. That's not good. Here it is. Here. I don't want to miss the last one. It's the best. So now we're going to read another version that plays much more loosely with all the same themes, but it is again a poem about impermanence, holding back age and the futility of that. So this is not pretending to be a translation, so it's simply titled After Horace. You can't fuck with fate, my friend, though it will surely fuck with you. Neither supplements or supplications will hold back the signs of age that defile your mirror. White hair, wrinkles, sagging flesh are only the outward signs of the inner decay that you fear the most. In vain you have battled your weight and shunned first fats, then carbs, then the drink and drugs that made city life bearable. Wives have left taking your savings with them. Lovers unloved moved on too. Your country house, that last refuge, will fall into the hands of ungrateful children who will ravish your wine cellar with ignorant abandon, spilling Cabernets fit for billionaires on poolside flagstones. So, how far have we come from Horace? Right? Is it, in what sense is it the same poem and the same message? Now, I would suggest to you that when I talk to you about the teachings of Shakyamuni or of Dogen, what I'm teaching you has about the same relationship to their original words as After Horace has to Horace. How do you feel about that? That'll be our subject of discussion this afternoon.